Feminist Perspectives on Science, Lecture 2, The Value-Free Ideal of Science. The traditional understanding of science is that of a value-free process of knowledge acquisition, which guarantees objectivity in its results. This is usually called the value-free ideal of science, or for short, the value-free ideal. According to this view, science is not really influenced by values in the content of the knowledge it produces. It produces, rather, an objective representation of the world as it stands, independent of human beings and the social, political, and personal values we hold, which play out in our lives. So, while science is of course done by human beings, that fact is somewhat irrelevant to the content of knowledge scientific inquiry produces. That content is value-free. At least, that's what the value-free ideal says. Understanding this position is an important first step in studying feminist perspectives on science. Firstly, because this view of science is often held by those who raise objections to feminist critiques of science, and it is the value-free ideal which feminist critics of science often object to. Without a good understanding of the value-free ideal, it might be difficult for us to have a good sense of exactly what's being argued by many feminist theorists we will be reading this semester. Another reason it's important to understand this view is that people on opposite sides of this debate can often talk past each other, failing to understand what the objections are to their arguments or points of view. Since we will be reading mostly feminist literature which actively opposes the value-free ideal, I want to make sure we have a good understanding of the value-free ideal it's reacting to, so we can think carefully and precisely about the sorts of claims feminist theorists on science are making. Any study about science, even social or historical studies, are inevitably dealing with claims about truth, nature, and reality. So there's going to be a bit of philosophy involved in working through these ideas. Don't be put off if you find this week's readings a little complicated or dense. This is the theoretical foundation, and we're moving on to practical examples in our session next week. For those of you who prefer less philosophy and more social science or history, there's plenty of that coming up. A final reason I want to mention as to why it's important to really get a good grasp of theories of the value-free ideal of science and the dialectic it has with feminist perspectives on science is that, given the fact that these debates take as their central concern the objectivity and reliability of scientific knowledge, it's important to understand the political tightrope we're walking. It's easy to characterize those who say that science is pure fact and doesn't have any sexist or racist values involved in it as ignorant or bigoted or just not caring about the realities of oppression facing women, people of color, and queer communities. But it's not always accurate to take this view, and we might be guilty of drawing up a strawman opponent. The truth is that the objectivity and authority of scientific knowledge is important for everyone. Just think of climate science deniers and the trouble we've had mobilizing a serious response to the climate crisis. Honestly, that problem has just as much to do with capitalist interests in sustaining the fossil fuel industry as it does with any intrinsic public distrust of science. But the propaganda campaign against climate science has at least highlighted the importance of sustaining public trust in scientific knowledge. When we do feminist critique of science, we must therefore be responsible and careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. Science, with all its political problems and historical connections with patriarchy and industrial capitalism, is still one of humanity's greatest instruments for uncovering information and techniques that can help us survive and thrive. So let's be radical, but let's not be clumsy. So this week, we're going to look at some of the arguments and rationale for the value-free ideal of science, and we'll consider what's at stake for people who argue for or against this position. Let's start by looking at our reading from Reichenbach's book, Experience and Prediction, before moving on to Lacey's and Douglas's books, to look at more recent debates in the value-free ideal. To tell you a little bit about Reichenbach and the logical positivist school he was a part of, he was a very prominent philosopher and physicist in Germany in the 1920s, He was a close associate of Albert Einstein, who helped him get a position as a professor of physics at the University of Berlin. Because he was Jewish, Reichenbach had to flee to the United States in the 1930s, after which he took up a position as professor of philosophy at UCLA. Now, it may seem strange that a physics professor ended up working in a philosophy department, but this was quite common among a popular philosophical movement called logical positivism or logical empiricism. The first half of the 20th century was a period in which science as a form of activity saw a radical increase in its epistemic authority, meaning that it started to develop a kind of monopoly on the authority to create knowledge. This meant that it started to replace other ways of determining legitimate claims about what reality was like, including philosophy. And in Germany during this period, this trend brought an influx of philosopher-physicists into philosophy departments and seminars who started to reconceptualize what kinds of knowledge claims philosophy was and was not capable of making, what philosophy's relationship was to be with the sciences, and how philosophy should now be done. The view proposed by the logical empiricists was that science is an all-encompassing source of knowledge, which consists of two categories of statements: tautologies, which included mathematical and logical formulae, and protocol statements, which included observation-based statements that could, in principle, be verified by the methods of empirical science. This had two major consequences. While they're related, the second consequence is more important for our purposes. The first consequence is that, according to the logical empiricists, there is no question whose answer is in principle unattainable by science, which dismissed immediately any notion of areas of knowledge that are not conducive to factual scientific investigation and analysis. Any philosophy of norms or philosophy of value or ethics or aesthetics as normative disciplines were incapable of producing knowledge, since claims concerning norms and values are not empirically verifiable nor deducible from empirical statements, and are therefore what they called pseudo-statements. This left the idea of genuine philosophy, scientific philosophy, which is what the logical empiricists promoted, with a significantly reduced role. That role was to clarify meaningful concepts and propositions, to lay logical foundations for factual science and for mathematics. In Reichenbach's words, to analyze the results of science, to construe their meaning, and stake out their validity. The second consequence, the one that's more important for our purposes, is that science, the only way of accessing reliable authoritative knowledge, is completely set apart from values. For the logical empiricists, it was a different kind of thing, which did not come into contact with or become influenced by the messy world of actual human behavior and social relationships. Scientific inquiry was structured and determined by logic, either by tautological statements, statements that are true by definition, or by observational statements, statements directly observed and verified by experiment. This philosophy of science, then, established a strict and clear boundary between facts and values that has carried over into much theorizing about science ever since. In Reichenbach's book, Experience and Nature, which we read the first chapter of today, we find a classic statement of the value-free ideal of science. Reichenbach makes a number of distinctions relevant to the value-free ideal. Firstly, he draws a distinction between the epistemologist, who researches knowledge, and the sociologist. He says the sociologist of knowledge takes into consideration the external relations of science, whereas the epistemologist, or the logician of science, takes into account only the internal relations of science. What does that mean? Well, knowledge is a concrete thing, he says. It involves speeches and human actions and books written. But these aspects of science are of a fundamentally different nature than the internal structure of knowledge. The sociologist, who studies external relations of science, is interested in things like whether all astronomers are bourgeois men or play instruments. But the epistemologist is only concerned with questions about the meaning of concepts, the presuppositions of methods, how we know sentences are true, the logical connections between statements. The sociological and the logical come apart in the processes of science, and you can study the actual core of scientific knowledge and logical reasons without any consideration or concern for the social context in which the research is done. This is connected to the second distinction he makes. Reichenbach distinguishes between the epistemologist and the psychologist. Science, he said, is a human practice, so it involves human thought processes and human behaviors. Actual scientists might make leaps of faith or decisions based on their character. For example, are they risk-averse? Or they might be great scientists, but nevertheless take certain things for granted as obvious, rather than insisting on an exact proof. Or they might use a lot of intuition in deciding on their research projects or in designing their experiments. But the epistemologist is not interested in how the scientist actually thinks, or researches, or comes to conclusions. That's the job of the psychologist. The epistemologist is interested only in the rational reconstruction of science. How thought processes would occur, or ought to occur, if they are consistently arranged according to the rules of logic. This is where he derives his very famous distinction, which is still widely discussed in philosophy of science today, between the context of discovery and the context of justification. The critical task of the epistemologist is to construct an understanding of scientific processes of knowledge in which actual processes of thought are replaced by justifiable operations conducted according to the dictates of logic. This, he claims, is where the real power of scientific knowledge comes from, in the fact that its justification really doesn't have anything to do with what people accept, or whether people like it or find it plausible or intuitive. It's to do with a separable domain or sphere of, well, reality, I suppose, which is logic and logical rules and inferences. We'll see more details later in the quarter when we discuss feminist challenges to the notion of impartiality, on how this kind of conceptual separation between the logic of scientific inquiry and the practice of scientific inquiry, very much a social phenomenon, has provided a foundation throughout the 20th century and into the 21st for making claims that science is value-free, that is, objective and not infected with political interests. The point is in the claim that these things can, in principle, be separated from each other, and that you can look at each exclusively by themselves, without taking the other into consideration. This has evolved over the decades since Reichenbach's book, which was written in 1938. But these debates are still going on today. Our readings of the books by Hugh Lacey and Heather Douglas give us a sense of how debates on the value-free ideal of science have been taking place in recent decades. So let's turn to that now. As Hugh Lacey explained in his book, there are three ways in which science may be claimed to be value-free. That is, free of personal, social, political, moral, and religious values. One, impartiality, or the claim that the internal reasoning of science is free of social values, such that scientific theories are accepted or rejected purely on the basis of their relation to available material evidence according to the highest available standards. 2. Neutrality, or the claim that scientific theories as a whole, derived in a manner consistent with impartiality, do not presuppose or imply any particular social or political judgments, or serve any particular social or political purposes. 3. Autonomy, or the claim that science is driven by purely epistemic concerns, detached from society's values in the form of interference from government, political or religious institutions, or the military. Scholarship on the interaction of science and social values have, at various instances, contradicted claims to each of these forms of value objectivity. Historical accounts have demonstrated the existence of government and military interference in the conduct of institutional physics, contradicting science's claims to autonomy. Psychological research has demonstrated the detrimental political effects of the publication of cognitive differences research, challenging science's neutrality. We'll look at that a little bit next week. And feminist epistemology has highlighted the influence of social and political values in the methodological assumptions of sociobiology research programs, challenging science's impartiality. And we'll cover that also later in the quarter. Some of these forms of objectivity or value freedom have also been employed prescriptively as ideals to which science should or should not strive. In many cases, we see a combination of both descriptive and prescriptive employments, mixing different types of value freedom. For example, it's claimed that science is not actually producing neutral knowledge, so scientific research shouldn't be given autonomy from social and political values. Perhaps the most famous debates concerning objectivity and values in science were those occurring in the context of nuclear physics research into the atom and hydrogen bombs in the 1940s and 1950s. In reaction to the nuclear physics research that had enabled the development of nuclear weapons, a growing number of concerned citizens and scientists put pressure on scientific institutions, put structures in place, and to make physics more accountable to broader social values. This included the formation of societies of scientists dedicated to controlling some of the aspects of scientific discoveries. These societies sought to restrict nuclear physics's autonomy by making it accountable to the broader social institutions, attempts which were justified by pointing to the lack of neutrality of the knowledge produced by nuclear physics. Of course, nuclear bombs serve a very clear political purpose. These critiques were met with responses that science should not be denied autonomy from the interference of society and its concerned citizens because it's not essentially a political enterprise. Such rejections of demands to constrict or forbid elements of scientific research for the social good relied upon a narrative of science's value freedom in terms of its impartiality of method. Edward Teller, the physicist responsible for the technical design of the hydrogen bomb, still used in most of the world's nuclear weapons today, employed notions of the neutrality and impartiality of science to defend its rights to autonomy in his message urging atomic physicists to, quote, get back to the laboratories. He said, quote, "The scientist is not responsible for the laws of nature. It's his job to find out how these laws operate." His contemporary, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Percy Bridgman, also defended nuclear science's right to autonomy on the basis of the impartiality of its method, saying that science simply invokes evidence to face, quote, "the challenge of an external world not understood." Scientific freedom is essential, he claimed, if the scientist is to understand nature. The gist of this argument, forms of which are still made today, as we'll see, is that since science is oriented towards extracting objective knowledge about an external nature from the use of an impartial method structured by logic and observation, it's distinguishable from any representation or utilization of that knowledge in the service of a particular end or ideology, and it bears no responsibility for those practices. It's important to understand that many of those defending science's right to autonomy and its status as neutral and impartial do not deny the existence of social and political consequences of scientific research programs, nor the undesirable nature of these consequences. They often recognize and dislike as much as anyone the role of science in military hardware, surveillance of dissidents, destructive and environmentally unsound industrial practices, etc., etc. They typically acknowledge the historical reality of, for example, Nazi eugenics, the oppression of women, racial and ethnic minorities, and LGBTQ people at the hands of science and scientific research. Often, what they defend in terms of science's objectivity is the impartiality of the scientific method. The scientific method, they say, when properly adhered to, is such that it produces objective truth, absent of the value judgments that plague other forms of knowledge and practice. This point will be very important for us as we get into feminist debates concerning impartiality later in the quarter. According to these defenders of science's autonomy, scientific method isolates the phenomena of nature from their social and political settings, and impartially derives knowledge of them from the evidence, paying no heed to the personal, practical, political, or social significance of the knowledge or its phenomena. There are no particular values in scientific knowledge, precisely because it is impartially derived from the evidence. Science's indifference to our politics renders it, quote, liable at any moment to produce results that demolish one or another cherished preconception of ideology. That was from Gross and Levitt. We might not like the evidence or knowledge. It may contradict what we hope to be true. For example, it may be unacceptable by feminist lights. But the evidence and knowledge are not value-laden. They're indifferent to and independent of our values, as long as proper empiricist procedure is followed. Accompanying these kinds of claims of the impartiality and neutrality and general value freedom of science is the claim that any non-neutral social or political consequences of scientific knowledge must belong to conditions outside the bounds of science. The external uses of objective scientific knowledge may very well be politically and socially value-laden, but the internal workings of scientific inquiry are insulated from such social and political effects because they have a method governed strictly and exclusively according to epistemic standards for obtaining objective knowledge about an external reality. Society and its values are halted, so to speak, at the laboratory door, where objective science, conducted by a value-proof method, takes over. Under this view, science per se can be clearly demarcated from society and the uses to which science is put in that society. While science per se is responsible for the production of knowledge, the implementation, the application of that knowledge is a social and political decision, and may therefore be considered the proper responsibility of the political and economic forces controlling our society. It's on this basis that objects of political concern, like nuclear weapons and industrial pollution, are clearly demarcated from purely scientific understanding. So this is a relatively modern representation of the value-free ideal of science, and hopefully you're getting a sense of how many of the claims made by Reichenbach in 1938 are echoed in these debates going on in the 1990s and actually still up to this day. Now, you might be tempted to justify the arguments for the autonomy and impartiality of nuclear physics research on the basis of a difference between science and technology. Nuclear physicists research nuclei. Governments and militaries build and utilize bombs, right? However, more recent debates on scientific research programs into cognitive differences between genders, sexual orientations, and races slip into similar patterns. We'll look at this debate in more detail next week, when we have a live session to discuss some readings which employ the value-free ideal to defend cognitive differences research, but it's worth considering it briefly in the context of this lecture. For those of you who don't know what cognitive differences research is, it's research that looks into, say, the neurological structure of the brain, different kinds of cognitive apparatus that you might find in brains of a certain group of people that are a little different to the brains in another group of people. for example, men and women. Do men have an intrinsically mathematical brain? Do women have an intrinsically caring brain, for example? Now, there is documented evidence that cognitive differences research like this actually causes harm and increased risk to women and racial minorities. So, in response to that documented harm of political effects of the publication of this research, some scholars of science have urged limitations on science's autonomy in the form of restrictions on such research. A lot of these critics who call for limitations on this research don't actually look at issues of impartiality. They just say, well, obviously, this research is not neutral, right? It has a very specific political interaction with other aspects of society. It harms people of color, it harms women, it harms gay people. So that's enough, really, for us to have a good enough reason to put limitations and restrictions on whether this research should be done. It's just evidently harmful, right? Sociologists have documented that. But the cognitive differences researchers and others in the scientific community, not all of them, but some of them, they still respond with a case for science's autonomy based on a picture of science as a purely intellectual process that is fundamentally different to and insulated from society and its values. This is a quotation from Janet Kourani's 2016 paper, which we'll be reading. What is problematic about cognitive differences research, they claim, is not the questions asked or even the results sometimes obtained, but the prejudiced, the racist and sexist context in which the research takes place. So basically what's being said there is, we just produce the knowledge. We're just scientists. We follow an impartial method. We discover the truth and we give you the truth. If you take that truth and you harm women and people of color on the basis of that truth, well, that's not really science's fault. Neither is it science's responsibility. We should still be able to go on, do our ordinary work with full autonomy to pursue whatever lines of research we like. So psychologists Sessi and Williams defend the right of cognitive differences research to autonomy, saying the scientific truth must be pursued. So they're making a leap there from the impartiality of their method to the neutrality of their results. They say that political or social consequences don't result from allowing scientists to publish their findings on correlations between race and IQ scores, for example, and that the demonstrated harm to identity groups results rather from the context in which the findings are received. Some scientists even appear incredulous that knowledge derived using scientific method could possibly give rise to negative political consequences. The responsibility must be elsewhere, because science is just truth-seeking. So for example, sociobiologist E.O. Wilson has claimed that, quote, social progress can only be enhanced, not impeded, by the deeper investigation of the genetic constraints of human nature. And biologist Lewis Wolpert has claimed that the more we pursue objective knowledge through science, quote, the better the chance we have to make a just society. Physicist Alan Sokal has also claimed that, quote, rational thought and the fearless analysis of objective reality, both natural and social, end quote, will necessarily lead to improvements in society. The kind of impartially derived knowledge of nature and reality that science is believed to provide has been described as an intrinsic good. That was also Wolpert. It's been described as one of the chief glories of man. That's from Bridgman, Percy Bridgman, who we mentioned earlier. And desirable human ends in their own right. The common assumption running through these claims is that the impartiality of scientific method, that is, the derivation of knowledge through the use of logic and high standards of evidence, observation, testing, guarantees either the value neutrality of scientific knowledge or the uncontroversial positivity of its consequences. This then validates requests for autonomy of science from socially or politically imposed restrictions. Science is just truth. It's just looking at the evidence and telling us what's real. Any bad that comes out of it must be going on elsewhere outside the bounds of the internal logical structure and evidential structure of scientific research. Now, it's probably not surprising to you that scholars of science have started to question the impartiality of scientific methods and whether scientific method really can guarantee the neutrality of its knowledge. Richard Lewontin, for example, has argued that it is, quote, not at all obvious that the methods and problematic of natural science produce an objective picture of the world, untainted by ideology and by the social and political predispositions of scientists. Andrew Ross, as well, has argued that there is, quote, nothing distinctive to differentiate science from any other social activity, end quote, and that the very notion of science's methodological impartiality is a dogma, which is, quote, used to fend off social criticism and to protect professional contracts with the corporate military state, end quote. What they're saying here is that you wouldn't make this kind of argument for politics or law or education, you know, that we follow a method, therefore nothing that we do which has any political consequences can be intrinsically our responsibility or our fault. Therefore, why on earth should we accept that kind of argument from science? Stephen Gold, Helen Longino, Phyllis Rooney, all of these people, some of which we'll read later in the quarter, have each challenged the impartiality of research programs in sociobiology and intelligence testing by demonstrating that the posing of certain questions and the derivation of those conclusions have partly depended on pre-existing social and political values and assumptions. We'll actually cover that in more depth in later weeks. Some theorists have gone so far as to suggest that impartiality of method is impossible to guarantee, and that scientific method should be intentionally altered and adapted to suit our proclaimed political values. We'll actually see that in one of Helen Longino's readings that we'll get to later in the quarter. Critiques of science's impartiality of method, while achieving a significant degree of success and acceptance in scholarly circles, have left a great number of scientists and scholars dissatisfied. Some scholars and public commentators have even attributed responsibility for the recent growth of populism to academic fields like social studies of science. They suggest that their challenges to the impartiality of scientific method has undermined public confidence in science and also in expertise more generally. Of course, there are others that say that the connections between scholarly literature and the rise of populism are tenuous, and I'm inclined to agree. I don't really think that academics have as much of an influence as we might flatter ourselves to think. The importance of public and government confidence in science has recently been highlighted, though, in the controversial rejection of the overwhelming scientific evidence for human-induced climate change by the President of the United States, for example. In a tweet in 2012, Donald Trump claimed that, quote, the concept of global warming was created by and for the Chinese in order to make US manufacturing non-competitive. As well as being incredibly racist, what he's saying here is that global warming is a hoax. And that's actually what he said in his campaign speech in 2015. He said there of global warming, a lot of it's a hoax. I mean, it's a money-making industry. In 2016, he appointed, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Myron Ebell, who had accused climate scientists of being a gang who'd been manipulating and falsifying the data, as head of his transition team for the Environmental Protection Agency. Trump questioned the neutrality of climate science research by suggesting that specific political and economic interests were served by the acceptance and proliferation of its findings. A claim that's arguably true, since climate science does indicate a need to reduce specific manufacturing processes and American reliance on fossil fuels, all of which disproportionately affect specifically situated citizens and industries. But ultimately, his challenges to the authority of climate science relied not just on the political inconvenience of climate science research findings, but they fell back on challenges to the impartiality of the method of producing scientific results. Impartiality that science study scholars, who usually occupy very different worlds and hold very different politics, have also devoted significant effort to challenging. Now, regardless of the causal connection between populism and scholarly challenges to scientific impartiality, which are hypothetical at best, the example of scientific evidence being unduly disregarded for the political purposes of justifying the repeal of the Clean Water Rule and the Clean Power Plan and the withdrawal of the United States from the International Paris Agreement on climate change all illustrates the importance of sustaining a popular narrative of at least some form and degree of scientific authority based on the reliability and trustworthiness, if not the absolute value freedom, of scientific methods. Treading this line has been a major challenge, not just in feminist critiques of science, but also in philosophy of science more generally, and discussions on science and values more generally. From the consistent appeals and challenges to scientific impartiality in debates concerning politically contentious science, it seems that impartiality is a very tricky notion to navigate. On the one hand, we don't want to encourage a belief in science as a process completely insulated from wider social concerns, which would justify requests for the autonomy of research programs that cause serious and documented risks to individuals or groups. But while we seek to make science accountable for its social and political consequences, we still can't comfortably deny that scientific research is capable of some form of impartiality that, if manifested, is deserving of our trust and is deserving of our respect when arriving at consensus on received opinion and when deciding on public policy. The suggestion that scientific method can and even ought to be doctored to better manifest predetermined social and political values doesn't really seem consistent with the much-needed trust in the impartiality of scientific methods. Now, these are some of the very complicated issues we will be discussing over the coming weeks as we explore feminist critiques of science, considering how science has been used as an instrument of domination, and culminating in our discussion of impartiality later in the quarter. Next week, we're going to look at a specific example of the value-free ideal being used in context through readings in recent debates over cognitive differences research, so we can get a clearer and more concrete sense of how the value-free ideal plays into feminist perspectives on science. So have fun reading those articles and those chapters, and while you're reading them, have a think about where you stand on the issue of impartiality and value freedom in science. Should it be defended outright, or is that too dangerous? Should it be challenged outright, or is that too dangerous? Is there some kind of middle ground that we can walk where we simultaneously hold science accountable and make sure that it isn't causing harm to vulnerable populations, but also allow science to have some kind of authority when it's really needed? I look forward to talking with you about that next week. If you have any questions about this lecture, leave a comment in the comment box or come and talk to me in office hours.